Good morning. Welcome to our forum for September. I'm Sheldon Jones. I'm the Vice President with the Farm Foundation. I want to thank all of you for being here this morning. It's a great group. Everyone can grab their seats right quick. I know there's still some folks coming in, but they keep us on pretty tight rope here at the National Press Club. I think they have a luncheon schedule for here right at noon, so we need to be prompt this morning. And I'll be introducing the speakers briefly. There was a handout out front with a more expanded bio on all of our presenters today. And Charlie Stenholm had some issues in Texas this morning. I'm not sure if he's a volunteer fireman or maybe it's not so volunteer. But he won't be here today, and so I will also moderate the discussion Q&A session for today's forum. So with that, we'll get started. The order of presentations today will be Dr. Scott Irwin will start us off. Scott is a professor at the University of Illinois, has been long involved in data collection and the economics of data and how that works both in the public sector and with some private sector work as well. Following Dr. Irwin will be John Hayes. John is with the Farm Credit Council, based here in Washington. And John will talk with us about not only the lending aspects, importance of information to their business, but also some policy ties to the value of agriculture collected and reported data. Tom Wegner, who's with the Economics Department with Land of Lakes, has a history of both in academics and cooperative extension, but also with the Ag Marketing Service and in the public sector, focusing on the dairy side of Land O'Lakes business. And he'll provide an agribusiness perspective on agricultural data and the value of that. Then batting cleanup for us this morning will be Robert Young. Robert's the chief economist for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Bob will give us a perspective from the producer standpoint, both as a reporter, provider of information through various surveys, through National Ag Statistics and others, and also a user of that information as a producer making decisions about their business. And so with that, I would introduce Dr. Scott Irwin to come up and kick us off. Kick me off, I guess. You're all better off for that. There you go, Dr. Irwin. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon, very much. I really appreciate the invitation to participate in this forum. I would have to say, maybe it's just early in the morning and I haven't had enough caffeine, but when you said I had long experience, I heard for a second, you know, and this is my paranoia working so much in Agriculture Outlook, wrong experience. So maybe I'm just, the markets have got me a little shook up like everybody else. Particularly on dealing with an important policy topic like this, I find it useful to kind of disclose, where my money comes from and my perspective so that you can put that in your filters as you listen to my comments today. Just 2 points I would make on this slide. And like most economists who are fascinated with markets, we end up trading mainly unsuccessfully. I've taken the last line from my good friend Brian Wright at University of California, Berkeley, who has termed me a farmer-friendly agricultural economist, and so I wear that label with pride. Okay, getting into the topic for today, my role is to really kind of set the table, so I'm going to give you the 50,000-foot overview of the agricultural data that is provided by the U.S. Federal government. And I like to divide it into two different pieces. The first, and by far and away the best known in the public, is what is generally referred to as current market data. These are the USDA crop reports, grain stocks reports, hogs and pigs reports. And so these are the basic market facts that in many ways power our markets. And I'll spend most of my time talking about the value of that kind of data. But there's also an equally, perhaps even more important component of our agricultural data system, and that is what I call policy relevant data. I just give some examples of data collected on conservation tillage, U.S. farm balance sheets, different kinds of trade barriers, population demographics, ethnicity of farmers. These are all inputs into our nation's policy deliberations. I'm going to just jump right now into how can we think about the value first of our current market data. And I'm going to try and put this as straightforward of way as I can to set the stage. This, of course, as an economist, I cannot have a presentation without a supply and demand graph, so here we go for today. This is what market equilibrium in every textbook looks like. It is price, let's say for 2012 for some commodity, let's say corn, and the price and quantity in equilibrium, you can see are where the supply and demand curves intersect. That's based on an assumption of perfect information. Looking forward, we know exactly what those supply and demand conditions will be. What if that is not the case, which is, of course, the norm? We might have a situation like this, that the market has information that leads it to project supply being too low. Well, that means relative to perfect information, the price will be too high and quantity too low. Likewise, we might have information that leads us to believe that the supply will be relatively high and shifted out to the right. That means price will be too low and quantity too high relative to a perfect information equilibrium. And of course, we can have the same kind of phenomenon on the demand side. We could have a projection of demand being too low, which means we get both price and quantity too low. And if we project demand too high, we'll have too high a price and too high a quantity relative to that perfect market equilibrium. And of course, you can have everything in between. This chart is really what reality looks like in the marketplace. Everyone is trying to figure out where are we in that red trapezoid. And so I think this helps us see what the current market statistics are really trying to do. From an economic standpoint, you want to try to shrink the size of that red trapezoid with public sector data. You want to reduce the total amount of uncertainty about getting close to the target. Or else another analogy is, I like to think about the center of that red area being the target. And public data gets you closer, on average, to that target than if it did not exist. And so that's just a simple way to, I think, communicate what these current market data reports do in our marketplace. Now, with that concept as background, there will, of course, be large differences across markets and across time in the value of current market data. And here is an example where maybe that range of uncertainty is very large because there's a very high degree of uncertainty. And in that environment, the potential value of public agricultural data is very high because you can be way, you know, the market may have such poor information that we're dramatically away from the center of the target without it. And of course, the opposite extreme is also possible. You can have a market where there just simply isn't much uncertainty about information for a variety of reasons. Could be the structure of the industry, nature of uncertainty. And in this kind of market situation, whether you have the agricultural data or not, probably doesn't matter a lot from a societal standpoint. At this point, I would just simply remark, which of these do you think looks like grain and livestock markets in the United States today? Is it the little red area or the big red area? Kind of obvious that in our current environment, ironically, when we're talking about these threats to our the federal support of our agricultural data system, that couldn't come at a worse time with respect to the relative degree of uncertainty and the need for the data, which is as high as it's probably ever been. Okay. Now, that's just a little bit of basic conceptual work regarding agricultural data, and that's just making arguments. What's the empirical evidence to support my basic argument about the value of our current market data system? It turns out that kind of data, we can actually test empirically whether it has value based on an assumption about the behavior of the participants in markets. If we assume that they're rational, it means that they won't change their market expectations after this data is released unless it contains something truly new that gives them better information about something like the size of the United States wheat crop. And so we can devise a test based on that idea. These are called event studies. And this shows you an example of how valuable agricultural information like wheat crop reports might impact price variability in an ideal market. We can say day zero is the day that that report is released, and then we have 5 days before and after. And you can see that variability of prices on the day of the release is much higher than normal. And this is one situation where much higher than normal variability from the perspective of data providers is a good thing. That is exactly what you should see if you're releasing information that the private sector doesn't already possess. Otherwise, there would be no trades, no price reaction, no changes. So this is, in an event study framework, what the pattern we would look for. Here is a chart analogous to that in some research I've done with colleagues at the University of Illinois on the price impact of USDA crop reports in corn. And basically, you see the rather remarkable result that price variability on the day that USDA crop reports are released, and these are across all four announcement months, is about 7 times normal. Price variability is about 7 times normal variability. And if you believe market participants are not stupid, then this means that this is the result of people adjusting to that information in their positions. And here's the punchline. This is based on a paper that the data ended in 2006. So imagine what if I redid this with data from recent years would look like. I mean, I don't know what the variability ratio would be, but it would be, I'll bet, higher than 10. And then there's soybeans. Picture looks almost the same. And these are but two examples of what is now an expanding and fairly large literature in the agricultural economics field that documents the economically and statistically significant impact of many different market data reports. And so this is hard evidence of the importance and market impact in a number of different areas. So what I want to do now is just switch very briefly to a quick discussion of policy relevant data. Determining the value of or I should say the economic value of policy-relevant data is quite different because it doesn't necessarily directly impact short-run market trades. Instead, it impacts the political choices of society. And I pose the question, should the U.S. government subsidize the adoption of no-till crop production systems? This is a policy question and a policy choice. And we do invest considerable dollars in data collection to help us analyze those kind of policy questions. The difficulty is that the value of policy-relevant data is the value in terms of the impact on what economists call the overall well-being of society. For those of you trained in welfare economics, this is the welfare effects of the policy. And as anyone who has worked in this area knows, measurement of these kinds of impacts is very difficult. But intriguingly, the magnitudes may be very, very large in terms of improving policy choices to our society at large. So with that, hopefully that will set the stage, and I will turn it over to Bob Wright.
Thank you, sir. Morning, everyone. I'm going to give a little bit of the lender's perspective, and as Sheldon mentioned, talk about the policy end of it. I work in the policy end, a lot of data analysis in order to look at threats and opportunities. I'm the senior VP of policy analysis and development, been to the council for about 11 years. I was with Farm Credit Administration before that, wrote regulations, so I've had a lot of policy experience, and it's important. Data tells a story, and in this town, as many of you know, you can tell a story to support or defeat anything. It's the same exact data, depends on how you want to look at it. But at the lender's view, all lending is local. Bigger institutions, local just happens over and over and over and over again. Our lenders look at things such as land values, the demographics, but more importantly, the makeup of the individual borrowers, their operations. They might not rely as heavily on national federal data, but they're going to have relationships with the state statisticians at NASS and what they get out of FSA. All of this they look at to evaluate risk. A lot of the outrageous land values and land prices we've been hearing about have come through auctions. Some of the private treaty sales that don't go through auction are a little bit less, so you can argue they're not getting maximum returns. Another view is the Hatfields and McCoys are trying to buy land, and they're just bidding and bidding and bidding. So I was at a lender's meeting when the one transaction was about $13,000 an acre in northeast Iowa. I got a lot of attention from lenders, like, you know, what is happening here? But that's very local data. That's not happening across the board. Demographics is an interesting one. Of course, lenders are going to know what's happening in their own marketplace. But looking at the federal demographics, primarily it's the ag census. That happens every 5 years. So when you look at your local area relative to what NASS reports it to be, you're going to live with that data for a while. Things are going to change. The next one is as of 2012. It'll be reported early 2014. And then you'll have that data for another 5 years. So that's one issue about current business, and I'm sure we'll hear a little bit about that. The timing of data, Darius mentioned, has got a lot of data, a lot of current data. Demographics and ag is different. Farm income is different through ARMS because they do their survey. By the time they work it out and report it, it's going to be a little dated, not current on the market, but it shows a good direction for which the market's moving. Lenders also need to know knowledge of the markets, again, from a risk perspective, trends in the different sectors. Dairy had quite a bit of stress for a while. Ethanol's had some stress. So those are all things that we have to look at. You're going to get data from whatever source possible you rely on in order to look at the risks as they affect your portfolio. Of course, commodities and competition as well. Most businesses are really information driven. Some is really current. You're going to have to find the best and, I guess, as you believe to be the most truthful going forward. Now I want to study kind of talk about the more macro level. I use data from any source I can find for the various things I look at. Recently been looking at the Rural Atlas. There's a lot of USDA folks in here. I like to think that you guys make me look good when I do the work. So thank you for all your data you work with. Some of it is on the rural America is a little more different to find. Sometimes I'm not real certain how the results that are reported look. Sometimes they don't quite make sense between different agencies. That must drive you guys nuts. In USDA, they have a rural focus. It drives me nuts. But at least I can look at the direction by which things are going, and that helps me look at what threats and opportunities for the ag lending market, and where does farm credit fit in that. Also look at, I call it the survey versus registry data. I've worked with a national organic program data, looking at the certification information. And there's not statistics behind that, that's just here's the certified institutions. And looked at farmers market information by location, looking at the, in effect, the database of the location of all the farmers markets that are registered. That recently went electronic, where you can get a download from the internet. I don't believe how long that's been in play, but that's wonderful data. It'd be nice to have that enhanced a little bit, collect some more statistical type information, but I don't know if that'll happen. On the subject of the budget pressures and implication for users of the data, these are the things of potential outcomes that, from my perspective, as it would affect me, and I assume affect others. The timing of data release could provide a gap in your data, would have market implications. About 90% of all trades on Wall Street, or they call these flash trades, they're algorithm run, they're just real quick in and out of the market. Heavily data driven. It also happens in the commodity markets. Imagine if some guy's got this incredible algorithm, very proud of, all of a sudden they miss a month because it's not published. Who wins? Probably the guy that had the other side of that trade because he just happened to be lucky. So that's a big issue too, the market implication. Possibly reduce sample sizes, it'll impact the estimates. You have a time series that you've been working with, that you're comfortable with. You just have to understand that. Elimination of reports, it's called reliability. All of us rely on information in different ways. If you don't have that anymore, where do you go? What is a proxy for what you've been doing? And that can cause a problem from the policy standpoint. How certain are you? But from the real people that need real current information, I mean, that'd be a travesty. If you didn't get dairy reporting, if that had to be delayed a little bit or you miss the timeliness of a report, it could cause problems. Staff reductions, I think there could be fewer follow-on studies or fewer reports issued. I really like reading others' work on the data, the raw data that I look at. It helps me get a perspective on where I need to go or how it could impact me. And then data enhancement opportunities, they're missed. I mentioned organic program and farmers market. Personally, I'd love to see more information on the infrastructure of the local foods process, who's participating, that kind of approach. I don't think we'll see that because of the budget pressures. It's too bad. Someday, I hope so. It's just a kind of a little breakdown of the issues I saw. As far as the timing of data release, that's a concern for me. But think about business, supply chain decisions. If you're trying to forecast your capacity needs, storage, transportation, marketing, and all of a sudden you don't have a data point that you've needed. From a business standpoint, that's a problem. I talked about like commodity markets and all the price makers and price takers. A lot of volatility. It's very volatile right now. You see Dr. Irwin's great big box, you imagine that getting bigger and bigger. Reduce sample size. Yeah, I think that might be reasonable that has to happen. A lot of these sources, it's the only game in town, but I think they use modern estimation techniques, so I don't see that as really affecting it too much. But some agencies use others' output as their input. A lot of federal government, they talk about the metropolitan this, the non-farm this. The USDA supplies their view of that. And to the extent it has to be used, these agencies rely on USDA work in order to further their work. So that could be a problem. My approach is just to understand the method, to understand the impact, to determine how to frame my conclusion. I want to just run through an example. I'll go into a little more detail. Ag Census, about 1.5 million responses, is estimated 2.2 million farms. Now look at the different size, and you can be the judge of how you think this works. Bureau of Labor Statistics, I've been doing a lot of work lately looking at rural and agricultural unemployment. 1.1 responses on average through 2010. They estimate there's 2.1 million occupations in the farming, fishing, and forestry. That's a 2,000 expansion from that number. They've been doing it for a long time, so that might not be too bad. But here's this example. In April 2011, unemployment rate in that, well, they call it something a little different. It's the ag and related industries, 19.3%, and up 2.6 percentage points over the year. The decline of 200,000 from March to April, huge, huge change. My contact at Labor Statistics thinks because the sample's so small, just a few people reported they were unemployed. Major impact. So was there 19.3% unemployed at that time? Sure. No. You know, it's hard to say. So you got to look at that. They suggested to me that I look at a three-month time period, not to get too concerned about the detail. But the observations are so low. But what gets interesting is they take that information from the BLS, and then they look at it by the NAICS code, and that's the North American Industrial Classification System. In effect, it has all the like support activities for crop production. They've got definitions on what the kind of firms are. As you can see, of the 2.1 million, reasonably, you know, 215,000 were from this industry code. The livestock support was about 15,000 to 19,000. So you can see the different areas there. Well, you get down to the bottom, these are the lowest ones. Promoters of performing arts, sports, and similar events. Reasonably, that could be rodeo. From my hometown, it was a combine demolition derby. It's fun. I've never seen it in person. Lindwa.org, I think it is, my hometown. Famous to some. we acclaimed it anyway. But this becomes an issue if you're trying to just dive down real far. So low sample size, large estimation, brought back down to some pretty definitive numbers. Now we're putting the two together to see how they work out. This is by occupation. This is different. This is the person. This is not the company or the business. You look at it on the crop, there's a 215,000. In the farming, fishing, and forestry, you see how that ties. There's a lot of other businesses involved where the person has some other type of employment. Some of them you really want to question. Protective service, you know, you need to have someone watching over your grain and fertilizer or rowdy corn stalks, I don't know. There was one that was, I don't know if I put it here, but it was personal services, and I think it was like beauticians. And like, well, farmers, you know, they gotta get haircuts. Bob and I are less worried about that. But by the time this really broad estimation gets pushed into the detail, it makes you question it. But in the aggregate, you gotta think it's okay. But just think if that 1,100 became 500. There's about 60,000 households are surveyed every month. An individual is on surveyed for 4 months. They're off for 8 months. Then they're surveyed for 4 months again. About 25% of the sample rolls off every month. So I guess you got to estimate really big to keep some smoothness to that curve. But when ag got up to that 19.3%, the highest sector unemployment, didn't make a headline anywhere. Maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, but I just kind of question the outcome of that. But it's statistically driven, and modern techniques were there. If a data product's eliminated, that's a concern. You know, we don't know what NASA's gonna have to do. They do so many different things they're gonna have to carefully review. But economists hate when their time series get disturbed, so that could be an issue as well. Staff reductions, I mentioned. You know, I like seeing what others, their view of the data that I look at. I have a very specialized view on as it impacts lending that may or not be covered, but a lot of time that's how I find a data source that I can go explore. We're having freezer lock here. There. Data enhancement. This is what I call a wish list. Unconstrained budget, and if you're able to do a lot of different things. This is the, what I call the registry data. Looking at the organic program, you know, just in a, down in the weeds, you're either a producer or a handler. You know, you call a handler a lot of different things to try to describe the infrastructure better. I did have a little frustration, to be honest, working on that when I first saw it. I figured, man, this data is put together by a committee. Well, in fact, it was. Every different certifying organization input their own data. And what a nightmare. So by the time I got done with it, what I was using was quite a bit smaller than what was put together. Conclusion, you know, I've talked to quite a few different people that provide this data because and trying to find out more about it. And I really trust that USDA folks are going to do a very measured, careful look at the data they provide, if they're told to cut back, what the implications will be. You know, at least that's the word I'm getting. I have no reason to discount that. But there could be some pretty wide market implications from that, different from the looking at industry that could have an impact. And look, in my view, some of the data I look at is dated. Whether it's Ag Census, demographics, or the ARMS that has quite a bit of good information about the financial, it's a couple years old by the time it gets published, but that's okay. It's the only game in town, and you just cite it a whole lot, and it points you in the direction things are moving. But just imagine if we had none of this. Kind of tough to do your job. You wouldn't have a lot of coordination anywhere. Happy to take any questions when it comes time, and thanks a lot.
Well, good morning. I have a little bit of a background in data. One of my first jobs was working for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture as an enumerator. So I'd call farmers, and it was always interesting. They'd usually ask, is it mandatory or voluntary? And when I told them it was voluntary, they said, great, let's go through the survey. So it's kind of interesting. In my work, I use data a lot. I used to work for the AMS Dairy Market News Program, so I come with a little bit of a knowledge of the frustrations, of the difficulties. Consistency versus accuracy sometimes enters into the discussion. In my work, I use a lot of different types of data, and I wanted to first off thank Sheldon Jones and Farm Foundation for having me in today. It's a nice opportunity to be a part of this panel. A little bit of an advertisement about Land O'Lakes. It relates, I think, to these data needs. We've become a much more focused operating company over the past 6 years. My return to Land O'Lakes has been about that long, where we really are focusing in a sort of a farm-to-fork type of approach. You see, we have the seed that we grow for the livestock that we feed. We know a little bit about milk production, a little bit more about dairy product pricing, and a little bit about branded product. So you can see across this entire supply chain, it's critical that we have good information to make decisions around our business plans. And Sheldon wanted me to talk about a number of things. I wanted to first elaborate a little on some of the complexities that we faced even in the dairy supply chain. I'm the dairy economist. It was interesting to, I think it was Sheldon who said, the economics department, well, there's one economist at Land O'Lakes, that's me. So that's a pretty big department. but dairy is really my home. And the complexity of the dairy chain is something that most people don't have a feel for, where we process the same raw product into multiple products, a little bit like timber, except it's kind of perishable. We price our milk to our members, the 3,000 dairy members that I work for, based on product use. So we actually pay them after we use the product and figure out what it's going to be. So it's a little bit unusual that way. At the same time, we have third-party sales to hundreds of customers across the country. Land O'Lakes has a footprint in California, the upper Midwest, and in the Northeast. So we have delivery points of farm milk to bottlers, to cheesemakers, even to some butter makers. Along these lines, as we become more connected into that marketing chain, full supply contracts, the idea of price discovery, what is milk going for, gets to be limited. That's some of the challenges I think we see within AMS, trying to come up with a free auction number isn't quite the same in milk. It's not like people stand off and say, hey, here's my 100 pounds of milk to sell today. So a little bit different supply chain there. And then probably the biggest change that we're seeing is sort of the global entrance of the U.S. Into the world market, and Land O'Lakes is really a big part of that. So this is what Sheldon asked me to speak about today. It was a little bit of value of public data to Land O'Lakes, a little bit about data collection challenges, and then some of the consequences of less public data. In a really simple sense, that publicly collected data is so important for us because it's reliable, it's objective. There's no vested interest that we see coming from a USDA. They don't care if milk is long or short. They don't care if milk price is high or low. They don't care if corn is high or low. The availability is really excellent as well. It's become more of a as-needed basis, on on-time basis. Very minimal cost. I know when I was with AMS, there was some talk about user fees. I still don't pay anything to see the Dairy Market News, which is the best source of dairy information. How many people deal with dairy at all here? I always want to know who the junkies are in the room. Because if you're looking for information on dairy, the Dairy Market News, and I don't just say that as a former reporter, it's got all the information. Getting it used and in a form that you can analyze is a whole other question. That's why my alma mater has the Understanding Dairy Markets website, which is an excellent place to go to find information, and they have it all aggregated and nicely set up for you. And certainly the revisions, they're very open about what they do with it. It's kind of interesting. I was speaking with Andy Novakovic before, and he said that NASA is great at data. They don't have any answers behind the numbers, and then the economists are great. They have answers behind the numbers, but they don't have any numbers. So it's I try to merge that a little bit in my work because you really do need to have some numbers. So I think the use of the ag data, there's some obvious places, certainly in our business planning, our long-range planning across the supply chain, make a lot of use of current numbers. I think the emerging place that we're seeing the critical need for timely data is certainly risk management. I'll say a little bit more about that, say a bit more about policy options, and then go back into my dairy world for a minute on the administered milk pricing. Risk management, you all know about the volatility that we're experiencing across many commodities. Certainly dairy has not been insulated from that at all. And we're seeing customers come to us and saying, gosh, we don't like dairy because we don't, you guys and all your federal milk orders and your MLIC, and just don't even talk to me about that stuff. I don't understand it. I understand corn. I understand commodities better. So they're actually asking us if there's a way we could actually lock a margin, which I find interesting because I think it's more complex in some respects. A feed over, or a margin over feed, is something that a customer of ours who buys dairy ingredients, a number of customers, some rather large customers, have said we feel much more comfortable with that than something sort of cryptic like a class 4 contract, which is federal milk order talk. So what we're finding is that we can take that from the customer and take it back to our individual producers because they understand margin over feed. Now, at the same time, I'm a dairy farmer's son from Wisconsin, and I've been asking dairy farmers all my life about, can they tell me what their cost of production is? It's a little scary sometimes how few can tell me that number. But I think more and more are understanding that margin over feed is a better metric for determining profitability than some milk price. When we used to target milk price, we still have somewhat of a, well, not really a target milk price. We have a price floor that's irrelevant right now, frankly. But I think that more farmers are realizing that margin is where the action is. And as you see the Foundation for the Future proposal out of National Milk and supported by Land O'Lakes, margin over feed is really what we're aiming for in terms of a target. So this margin is something they're hearing about. The upshot of why data is important is we settle with those dairy farmers every month based off this contract of margin. And we need a NAS corn, we need a NAS soybean, we need a NAS hay, and we need an AMS class 4. In order to do that, and then we derive back the cost to the customer. So this is the new area of risk management that's becoming bigger and bigger and will continue to become bigger and bigger. I think that, I mean, the toothpaste is out of the tube, so to speak. We're in the global marketplace, and that's adding a lot more volatility, in my opinion, to the prices that we see here in this country, so that and there are factors beyond our control in that global marketplace. So we, not only as producers, and we are owned by producers, we as Land O'Lakes have to do a better job of managing risk, and you have to have a better source of information to do that. Going to dairy for a minute here, I think this kind of starts to mesh in the market data and the policy data, where these milk prices that we put together are really important from a Land O'Lakes perspective because they're our number one raw material cost. Oh, and they're our members' number one income source. So it's pretty important that we get it right. So it becomes really critical to get good information. We've gone to an end product pricing approach in milk pricing and federal orders. So you need to go out and gather information from the marketplace that we provide in terms of our end product prices, our butter sales, our cheese sales, our whey sales, our non-fed dry milk sales. So the upshot is the federal order program can't operate, and I'm not here to be fully employed by the federal milk order program, although I was before. It's a really critical data-rich place, but data-dependent place as well, and that's where I think NASS, AMS, and USDA in general come into play. This is some of the stuff I use, and this is just to give an overview. I mean, all these pieces come into play across our supply chain, and a lot of disparaging comments have always been made about USDA's accuracy, but the one thing I know about USDA is I generally know how they do it. I generally know when they'll do it. So there's a reliability, a consistency that's very important to me as an economist, and it'll continue to be important as we move ahead. And this gets a little bit to, again, how we're driving more and more, I think, in the dairy industry to a data-dependent policy. And this is pretty important. So of the hands that were raised, how many of you are reading deeply of the Foundation for the Future policies? And then how many of you are aware of, Bob, I know you're aware, of supply management as an opportunity that's being put forth in that proposal? Policy option, Bob wants me to make sure I say. The least controversial piece of Foundation for the Future, wouldn't you say, Bob? Anyway, this gets kind of serious because where it's going is, again, pegging off of margin, but you have to have accurate data to determine whether to implement the machinery of supply management. So this all milk price is one of those key barometers, and my colleagues and I are very concerned that this is a representative number. It's consistently reported across states and respondents. Now, do you include milk that's been contracted? And this is a little bit the gum and candy question, a little bit of, you know, do you say that a farmer who's contracted in this month, that his price was actually established X months ago? Or do you say, no, this is what milk is actually going for? I mean, this is not a simple decision. It's a simple decision to make, but it's hard to understand which one do you go to because it's going to impact this milk price. It's going to impact this decision whether we implement this supply management program. So this is a pretty big deal. Will these numbers be audited? In the federal milk order program, we're auditing numbers that go in to determine price. Will we now audit milk buyers on their price? And this gets to be a big deal. This is hundreds of transactions by Land O'Lakes in a single week. This could be quite a bit of work, but if you're going to go to something like this, I'd agree with Bob, you want to take it very carefully before you exercise that option. But again, another reason why administered pricing is really dependent upon good data. So the question was raised about whether, you know, what would you do without USDA data? I mean, like I said before, I mean, USDA data has got that reputation of an objective collector of data. It's consistent, uses good statistical methods, little costs. What would you do if you were going to do more? What would you do if you're challenged with the question of, you know, USDA can't afford its current data approach? And I think there may be some collection efficiencies to exercise here. Are there maybe a regional data collection? I remember when I was that enumerator back at the Department of Agriculture, we had a dairy specialist who'd been doing it for X years. And I don't know if we can have that luxury of every state having a dairy specialist. I mean, from my selfish point of view, do everything but keep all the dairy data, please. But seriously, perhaps, I mean, you see this in universities as well, where you have regional specialists. Maybe that's a way to go. Are there more partnerships with universities? Certainly the Center for Dairy Profitability, lots of financial information collected there. I don't know if we've mined completely even State Departments of Agriculture. I look at the California Department of Ag. They do audits of actual manufacturing costs in dairy product plants. We use those actually to evaluate our own metrics when we put together our financial plans. So there's some good data out there to mine. Are the rules standardized as they stand right now? Is dairy reporting that I've talked about a couple of different times, where we really are auditing the sales numbers to make sure we have the accurate and the right numbers in front of us, is that a model to use in some other places as well? Some of the new data sources, partners, maybe Farm Credit. I've always been really impressed with the Springfield Farm Credit Bank, with the amount of data they put out. I would like to see that across the country, frankly, and maybe that can be tied together. Certainly the accounting services, we hear, frankly, ad nauseum from a number of them, that they have the best data on dairy. I think cooperatives might be a great source. When you look at the presence and the role of cooperatives in certain states, I mean, Florida controls, a couple cooperatives control the vast majority of the milk there, probably in the 80 to 90% of the milk. Boy, it'd be an easy phone call to ask them where's supply going on a monthly basis as opposed to trying to survey farmers. And certainly some of the forecasting firms. But to get close to wrapping here, I would be very concerned if we didn't have data. Certainly the objectivity and the quality. I mean, I joked about, you know, farmer hearing from USDA and asking if they'll voluntarily participate. I don't know if a consulting firm calling up and say, hey, can I get your numbers on the cost of production? Can I get your cow numbers, et cetera? That's gonna take some learning for an individual dairy farmer, even a company, to turn that over to a private company, because you wanna make sure that that's kept confidential as it gets aggregated. Would the cost go up? I mean, we talked about user fees. I mentioned that earlier. I haven't seen them impact my world. Certainly we would be having some difficulties with planning. We'd have to find another data source, and I think we would be a little bit more limited on our risk end. I think price discovery is probably one of the more interesting topics, because we're seeing, as you look at the globalization of dairy, we've got a reverse auction that's electronically held twice a month for non-fat dry milk on the dairy side. 300 buyers come to the table, 300 plus buyers come to the table, or come to the computer terminal, I should say. With Australia, New Zealand. Now we're gonna get California dairies, we're gonna get Dairy America participating from this country. We're gonna get, I think, a large British dairy processor participating. So there's some new things happening in the way we see these at arm's length transactions happening. You don't have to be face to face. Electronic trading happens in many other markets. I think we're gonna see some of that in our global markets now as well. This last one about, it's an easy one to say volatility is gonna increase if we don't have data. I think Dr. Irwin, you know, laid out the case for why that might happen. You know, it comes down to whether we would overshoot, we would undershoot on the needs for the marketplace. Would an individual producer overshoot or undershoot on his production on a milk side? I don't know if that would be the case. I mean, that's part of the issue why we're talking about a supply management program. Right now, would an individual producer really be impacted? I think they'd be impacted in the terms of their risk management opportunities. I think that's as important as anything. So certainly some costs of not collecting data. In terms of emerging issues, timeliness, electronic reporting, really, really something that more dairy farmers want. We're going to an electronic platform right now on the dairy side for the Federal Milk Order Program. For those end product prices, I've got dairy farmers that every time they see me, they target me and tell me, why not every day, Tom, why not every day? My response back to them is, so you would do something different if you had it every day. That's a good question that I don't get a good answer for sometimes, but it does help in terms of their confidence that they know that their milk prices are based on current data. Mentioned this earlier about the federal policy driving new data needs. Submitting data on a web platform, long overdue in my opinion, something we should be doing. Sustainability initiatives I threw in there because it's coming into the corporate world more and more. We continue to talk about it. I think we're getting out of this. It's all about efficiency. We're understanding that it's about more than efficiency. It's about other types of metrics, social metrics. It's about environmental metrics. And whether those things would necessarily be connected to more of a base level reporting that comes from the USDA or Department of Commerce, that would be very interesting. But probably the biggest emerging issue that I think requires more information is the globalization of dairy, globalization of agriculture. And this is a great example. You see here on the red line on the top, from 2002 to 2011, we've nearly tripled the amount of solids that we're putting out of this country, putting it into China, putting it into Mexico in the form of powdered milks, certainly lots of cheeses moving into Mexico. Huge, huge commitment. We are really subject to that global platform, and we need good information. And I mean, Canada's really good, Australia's really good, but once you start getting to, you know, like even an EU, all those different countries not reporting the same amount of data at all, and then you go to a China, and you're kind of like, what are we talking about here? It is really, really difficult to get good information, and we've got a significant opportunity in China. And I think this one kind of sums up how we're a globalized country. 2009, I think there was mention of it was a bit of a difficult year. Well, we took $10 billion out of the cash revenue side for dairy in this country in 2009 out of a $30 billion base. It's a pretty big number. Belgium dairy farmers weren't too happy that year either. Here they are liquid spreading their milk on their fields. So to close, I would just suggest that we really value the public data that we get here, see real need for continuing it, strong advocate of that collection, and that maybe there's some new partnerships that we could leverage to avoid duplication and even get better data for a little less cost. So I'll turn it over to Bob to correct all the mistakes I've made.
Well, I'm going to hit a couple of buttons here real quick and do that. See if we can't do that. I'm going to avoid a PowerPoint this morning with you. I apologize. I kind of got the call last week to say, could you cover for somebody that couldn't show up? And so here we are. I do think, you know, we've been following this issue very closely for the last several months, year or so, as I think... you know, we've been in tight budget situations before, and I think all federal agencies have responded to some of those before. I think many of you will recall that used to be a day that these reports actually showed up in your mailbox, and you actually had paper, and you could, you know, you had to file all that stuff, and I had file cabinets full of those reports, and I almost had to dedicate a weekend to, or, you know, a Sunday afternoon a month to, you know, just file all that stuff, you know, that came in. And then we basically said, no, we're not going to do it that way anymore. It's all going to be electronic. If you want the paper stuff, you can get the paper stuff, but you got to pay for it. And that was a big move. That was a big change on NASA's part, and not just NAS, but really kind of government ERS-wide as well, as we went through that shift. And so now here we are, and it would be easy for folks to just say, well, you know, we'll kind of muddle through this, and we'll come out the other side of this downsizing or this budget crunch, and, you know, life is going to continue pretty much as it was before. I think I got to tell you that I think this time's different. That I think as we come through this budget crunch, that and I don't mean just NAS. I mean, you know, USDA, federal government wide. I think we're going to come out of this process about 2014 and talk about a government that looks substantially different than it does at this point in time. We're going to talk about, as we already know, we've already got 2 years of budget freezes in place. I think we're going to talk about some noticeable personnel changes by the time we get out to 2014, just because we're going to have to. I mean, that's where the budget numbers are at this stage of the game. And when you think about an agency like a NAS or like a Census, you know that an awful lot of their budget is tied up in salaries. It's not product. It's not delivery expenses or whatever, it's salaries. We don't have all those publication costs, those printing costs that we used to have. You know, we just, that stuff's gone. And so we are pretty much at this stage of the game down to just people costs. And when you start talking about significant reductions in people costs, you have to talk about what are we not going to do in the future that we're doing today. And so I'd like to say, you know, sure, we can just do this tomorrow and we can do that the next day, and life will go on and everything will be great. But I do think that we all have to recognize that we're going to talk about noticeably different business models 24, 36 months down the road than the business models we were talking about 24 months ago. And that's just a fact. NAS, Census are kind of two fairly small cogs in this great thing that we're going to go through, but they're important to us. You know, if you're the last guy killed in the last skirmish or the last, you know, battle of the war, you know, you're still dead. So, you know, there you go. I when we talk about this from a reporting standpoint or a data collection standpoint or whatever, of course, everybody knows that their report is the most important report that NAS produces. We all know that. But I do think that we all recognize, and our organization certainly has gone through this process or is going through this process, you know, recognizing that, you know, maybe every report every day is not, you know, we recognize that we're going to have to do something different and are willing to have that kind of conversation. We've been asked on more than one occasion to go on letters to say, we got to maintain this report. And we've kind of refused to do that at this stage of the game because, again, I think we understand that NAS is going to have to go through and Census are both going to have to go through some pretty tough decisions here over the course of the next 24, 36 months or so in order to take us to the other side or in order to function under the kind of new realities that that we're all going to have to function under. You know, that having been said, I think there are ways to do this and there are ways to do this. You know, we all want NAS, we all want USDA collecting this data. As has been talked about, they are the objective collector of this information. It's one thing for an industry to do a survey. It's another thing for the government to come in and do that survey, and we can all come up with any number of examples of reports. Oilseed crush is one that comes to mind, but there are any number of others, cotton reports, et cetera, that the guy could come up with that industry does a survey, but you really want USDA kind of behind you, backing that data up, confirming that data, you know, collecting the real data, if you will, as we move forward. So, you know, having said all that, I do think that as NAS goes through this reorganization effort, there are ways to come at it, and there are ways to come at it. You know, you can maybe go too far too fast, and end up with a constituent base that has historically been. Think about this. To my knowledge, we haven't had a conference like this for any other agency within USDA so far. And I think that says an awful lot about the respect, the admiration, the desire to keep NAS as we go through this process. I don't think we've had a conference like this for anybody else so far yet. Not to say that we won't, but that I don't think we have yet. Part of that, I think, is because NAS is thinking ahead, trying to be proactive as they go through this process. But again, also because this is such an important issue for all of us as we go through this conversation. You know, do you go from, think about the reputation that a state statistician has literally across the country. That state statistician walks into a room, makes a comment about some issue or whatever, almost all the disaster estimates that we've had so far, the disaster loss estimates that, you know, when NAS says the number is $1.6 billion or whatever the number happens to be, but that's pretty much the number that everybody gloms onto and works from as they go through the rest of their efforts to try to get assistance packages put together, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's very important for us to have those state statisticians, I think, across the country. So efforts to say that, you know, let's go to a collection of regional offices. I'm just going to pick a number out of the air. Say 9. You know, that talks about a very, very different structure and a very, very different level of grassroots support for NAS in the future than what you have in place today. And do you really think you want to make that jump in one step? Or is that a bridge too far from where we are at this point in time? I don't know. I think that merits a lot of conversation as we kind of move forward. I'd also say when you think about, you know, some of the activities, some of the processes that NAS uses, you know, think about ag prices. And I've had this conversation with several of you in the room before, that when you think about it, you know, our justification for big chunks of the ag price report is, you know, the old parity. that's the justification, that's legal justification for collecting a lot of the data that we do. You know, is it time to, this is going to be blasphemous, and Chuck, I'm sure you're going to write on this tomorrow. You know, is it time for us to think about that as a justification for collecting data? And maybe even talk about that from a legal standpoint or from a legislative standpoint as well. You know, I'd also say that our producers, our membership, to a large extent, you know, can get pretty upset about NASS reports. I'll talk historically and say, you know, I remember some of the challenges that we had with hogs and pigs reports, that there was an awful lot of angst and concern about hogs and pig reports in the late 80s, early 90s or whatever. And I think NASS responded to that, and the industry's also adjusted as well. Most recent example, certainly the plannings reports, the prospective plannings, and then the plannings reports that we had this year. You know, the plannings report changed the value of the corn crop by $10 billion in about a 3 or 4 day period of time. That's a pretty good shot. And so, you know, we'll get this kind of producer angst about the reports. But I'd also say that as conversation about this restructuring went forward, you've got almost just as much angst among our membership about let's be careful about how this restructuring goes on, as almost more volume on that front than we had on the, oh, those SOBs, what are they doing to us again with the next report? So I do think that is an area that that also merits an awful lot of concern. So I guess in closing, I would say that, you know, I think we all recognize that, again, world's going to be different 24 months, 36 months than it is today. We recognize that. We want to be smart about how we get from here to there. And we're certainly ready, willing, and very desirous of having lengthy conversations with NASS as they go through that process and talk about, again, how we move from here to there. I'd also say I'm surprised Mary left, so I can say this, because I know she was leaving at 10, so I can say this, that we're not having this conversation about other agencies as well, because across agriculture, because this is a conversation that we do need to have about a lot of agencies at this point in time. With that, let me shut up, and I think we'll be ready for questions.
Very good. Thank you. I would like you to join me in thanking our panelists here right quick for their presentations this morning. And I think many of you are repeat guests here at the Foundation Forum. We have a microphone here in the middle of the room, and so please make your way to the microphone, and we'll open it up for questions and answers. And I'm sure as many hands as I saw raised and heads nodding, I don't think you were nodding off. I'm sure there's some questions in the crowd. Yes, sir. Oh, there'll be more. And please speak into the microphone. This is audio recorded, sure, and will be available on our website tomorrow afternoon. So
I'm Andy Novakovich from Cornell.
And please
University.
Identify yourself, sir, if you would.
Okay. I'm Andy Novakovich at Cornell University. I have a couple of comments, I guess, but also a question. I've been a user of data for some 35 years now. I do dairy work primarily. And one of the things that I would definitely observe is the amount of data, the number of variables, the frequency with which they're reported is much reduced from when I first got into this. And it begs the question, what bad thing has happened because I don't have this data? And I think it's a reasonable question. We all ought to be prepared to answer that. And surely there's some of that data that just simply outlived its usefulness, that we really don't need it anymore. But I'm also struck that, yeah, there are some things we're missing. Our ability to look at things beyond the national level, more granular than the national level, is much reduced. And for people like Scott and I who work in states, that's important. For people like Tom, who has, if not state, at least sort of a regional interest, that's important. County data are very hard to come by, and for some folks, that's important. So the absence of data is reflected, I think, in a lot of different ways, and regionality was not one that I heard particularly mentioned that I would highlight. Tom mentioned administered pricing needs good data. Bob talked about data collected because of a policy. You happen to mention one that's expired. I would observe, and I don't know if Tom would agree, that actually administered pricing creates a lot of data. We have a rich variety of data in dairy simply because the federal government regulates the industry so precisely. Now, one can debate the merits of that system, but data is a byproduct. An example where that intersects with NAS is NAS milk production estimates rely on federal order marketing's data to be more efficient in making their production and rely less on statistical surveys. If we have more deregulation, which Tom alluded to, I think that will erode some of our data availability. I don't know, Scott, if that applies similarly in food and feed grains, but I think we need to recognize there's some connectedness here. And I find it particularly interesting, and perhaps our lender and our marketer would agree, that as we have more deregulation, the need for market information increases tremendously. And so it's going in, I think, opposite directions. It's almost like you asked me to speak here, I guess. I'm sorry. But I will ask a particular question. NAS is not the only USDA agency that generates data. You've commented on that. USDA isn't the only agency that generates data important to agriculture. And I was a little bit surprised, maybe particularly Tom, if I can pick on him a little bit, that the lender was the one who talked about downstream data, and Tom really, really didn't, probably sticking more to his assigned topic. BLS data. What do we know about consumption? What do we know about what's going on in retail stores? What do we know about what's going on in food service? What do we know about prices along a value chain? Those become incredibly hard to gather. And if I can wrap this up and make something sound like a question, I'd be interested in your comments about downstream value chain data and these other aspects such as regionality that really, to me, suggest preserving what we have isn't really our only challenge. Sorry for the speech.
Somebody want to start that off, Tom?
Yeah, sure, I'll take a crack since Andy mentioned my name three times. Seriously, we're spoiled in dairy, frankly, because of the Federal Milk Order Program in a lot of ways, and there are a lot of interconnections, and it is a data-rich system. There's few programs where I can tell you how many producers delivered milk in Chicago by county basis on a monthly basis, any type of other commodity, not that type of information available. So I think it's a really excellent point that the administered programs support some of the other data collection efforts of NAS, for example. And the regional approach, I mean, if I was to say, how would you go about downsizing dairy, I would think you'd wanna, and we've seen some of that with the 23 state top dairy states are the ones that they really put the estimate muscle behind. Maybe it's time to even narrow that down a bit more, go to monthly reporting there. But yeah, to imagine there wouldn't be a dairy specialist in Wisconsin, New York, certainly Idaho, California, leaving out Minnesota, probably should mention some of the other ones. But I think it's really key to realize where the data primarily resides in terms of the sector itself. A little comment about downstream value. I'm not the marketer within Land O'Lakes, but we certainly rely on our own gathering of information regarding prices, and it is critical, and it is a bit ironic. I tried to make a little bit of an argument there that the data needs are expanding rather than contracting, and they're different, certainly. You know, it's nice to know how many pounds come out of Fond du Lac County, my home county in Wisconsin, on a monthly basis, but that isn't going to make a difference in terms of what we do at Land O'Lakes. So if we don't have that, the world will still go on. On the other hand, knowing what's going on in China, as Fonterra, the large cooperative of New Zealand, comes in and starts putting down 3,000 cows, and we look to feed those cows with our feed, they look to put more pods down. Be great to know what's going on there. Try to find a price for product out there. Good luck. So I'd agree that it's definitely more and more data, different data is what we're aiming for in this, and it's certainly beyond USDA NAS. I mean, Department of Commerce with the soybean stuff, pretty critical. BLS. You made me a little less a fan of BLS looking at some of those multipliers. Yeah, but so that's some thoughts on that.
Just a quick quick mention about the downstream. I've used the Rural Atlas data, and that's on a county basis you can get. And it's interesting to me, it appears that some of the lowest unemployment rates in the United States are in farm-dependent counties. That doesn't sync very well with a 19.3% unemployment rate in one of the aspects of the ag industry. I'm still trying to figure that one out. But it is interesting when an agency like BLS, not to pick on them too much, when they downstream it, they use a lot of estimation to put in these little buckets. But to try to build from the bottom back up, you'd have to look at each one of those of the occupations, figure out what the unemployment rate for that would be, employed and unemployed. And just by the time you get to the top, I would hope the numbers would equal. But it's interesting. I combine data sets. So you have an estimate of one data type, and you compare it and cross-tab with an estimate from another data type. And sometimes you work towards about a fourth derivative, which isn't supposed to occur in the natural world, but it can. And kind of like CBO math sometimes, not quite sure. But I look at it from a lender's perspective, and then the information I get, especially at the county level, I share with Farm Credit Institutions so they can see an outsider's view of what their territory might be, then they can compare their own experience to that.
I was just going to mention in the Midwestern grain markets that the issues certainly are broader than just NAS. For example, now one of the most important federal government reports affecting the corn market is the weekly ethanol production report out of the EIA, the Energy Information Administration. So the emerging links between the energy sector and agriculture through our biofuels production means that the data that's important to the sector have expanded well beyond the traditional agricultural areas. And that's just one example.
Any other thoughts on downstreaming or other of the questions? No? Bruce?
Bruce Knight, Strategic Conservation Solutions. I've had a chance in the last year or two to work with a number of clients that are developing life cycle analysis for their various aspects of the industry and working with a number of folks on their sustainability initiatives, all of which get considerably better the more data that there was ability to access. But with many of the LCAs, I'm finding actually a shortage of data out there, or industries are compelled to use USDA data in ways that were never originally envisioned when we started doing that data collection. And so I'd like to ask each of the panelists, what do you see for the trend line out there for sustainability data needs, life cycle analysis data needs, and how do we rise to that? I mean, the whole topic today is how do we maintain the data levels we have now with a declining federal budget allowable? How do you actually meet tomorrow's data needs in this same climate?
Well, Brian, I guess I would, I know you're familiar with the field to market effort that Keystone started some while back that a fairly large coalition put together around at this point in time. You know, and the metrics that they've come up with are really to the stage that they can be used in a life cycle analysis effort. Some stuff that Kellogg, for example, has done with it would literally take you, you know, all the way from the field to the box of sugar frosted flakes on the shelf. And part of the challenges, though, that I think some folks have faced with some of that LCA work in the past has been exactly that, that the data's not been there, the metrics haven't been there, and so you've had some folks rely on European production practices to drive LCAs for the United States and challenges that that's created. You know, I think as you can, the Keystone effort has started with a real push toward using publicly available data. The latest round, though, is to go to, literally farmer assessment tools, individual farmer assessment tools. So here's an example of the industry, if you will, going off and trying to put together its own data collection methods Long way to go. You wouldn't use the data at this point in time, all the good stuff, all those qualifiers around it, but an effort in that regard. But again, I think that's just indicative. You know, we're just probably more than likely not going to have the same kind of data 5 years from now that that we had today. That's sad. I don't necessarily wish that to be the case, but it is a reality that I think we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, I don't work in that area or study it, so I'll pass. I'd hate to say something that's blatantly wrong, and Bruce, who has an office probably 50, 60 steps from mine, would visit me too much.
Again, I'm not directly familiar with the work in that data area, but I do think that the question raises a broader issue, which is, are there opportunities for reallocation of the current activities to better optimize the data products that are offered? I think hopefully NASA is thinking through what kind of reports and areas can be cut, and what kind of, it'd be really interesting to know what is their criteria for making those kind of cuts. As an economist, I can certainly offer some guidance from what our economic theory says are the most important data reports. But the other thing that I'm really interested in, have been thinking about lately, is the possibility of application of, technology is changing and making the collection and dissemination of data so different than it was even a decade ago. And there may be a scope for using technology and some of the concepts that are seem kind of way out of the box now, like the idea of swarm reporting, may not have all the nice statistical characteristics that we like, but from an economic standpoint, may be very useful. And I'll give you one example that I'm fascinated with right now. One of the biggest online agricultural websites is agweb.com, and they started this year an online real-time reporting of corn yields. Now, it's a very interesting potential with the kind of yield monitoring equipment that farmers have, and I'm just watching as the few reports filter in, how those are eventually going to line up with the NAS number. So I think that there is actually a lot of scope for a creative use of the new information technologies and new ways that people in the agriculture sector are linked up through social media and so on to potentially enhance and reallocate the data that's collected.
A couple thoughts about sustainability life cycle analysis more specifically. Land O'Lakes has participated in that life cycle analysis of fluid milk, which the University of Arkansas, I think, spearheaded. We don't have a fluid milk processing end, so we didn't have to provide those kind of data. The next step is certainly to take it to other dairy products that we make, and at this point it hasn't really moved into those butter, cheese, powder, et cetera. Around sustainability in general, I mentioned that as a place where I agree. I think there's going to be a need for more information, more data. As I understand from our perspective, we are trying to get a better number on water use, on energy use. We're being careful. We're being cautious, I guess, is how I'd characterize us at this point. How far we're going to go? Are we going to start to go to suppliers and ask them for the data? That starts to get a little harder to pull that out of it. But at the same time, our customers, like a Walmart, like a Costco, are asking these questions. So at this point, we're reacting more to the requests from customers. The regulatory part hasn't come with the force we thought it might under the climate change bills that were proposed a couple of years ago. So it's certainly something that that we have our eye on. Individual reporting seems to be where it's going at this right now, and I don't know if university-led efforts are kind of the future, at least immediately. You probably know better about that, Bruce, that universities are pretty involved in this type of work as opposed to government at this point.
Next question.
Yes, my name is Jerry Cessna. I'm with USDA AMS Dairy Programs. And my question, I got a couple of questions. One is, I've heard a number of you speak to it, and maybe somebody wants to make some more comments about it, of why or why not, why private industry couldn't do some of these same reports, take over some of the same reports that USDA is doing. And then the other question is, does it make sense that the taxpayer is paying for this data? And should it be at no expense, should it be free to the user to receive that data?
Who wants to start this off?
Well, since Jerry's dairy, I guess I have to. Private industry doing it, certainly a possibility. I think there's going to be some getting used to the idea of somebody else calling and asking for information, and hi, I'm with Informa Economics, or hi, I'm with Blimling. Nothing wrong with those, are great firms. Nothing about their reputation. Just feels a little different. Would there be confidentiality ensured? It'd have to be that way. It'd have to be unbiased. And would it be, I mean, are there savings in shifting the work to private industry? It's about people. So are you replacing all the federal data collectors, state data collectors with private? Is that going to really be a cost saving? I'd raise that question. Taxpayer funded, I think there's some benefits. Scott identified, I think, some of the benefits of market information. So I'm comfortable saying that this is a public good that should be continued to be supported. Free to users, I guess the question would be what kind of cost and what kind of return would you get for it? Right now, it's all publicly available, and I think that's an important aspect of the data as well.
You're asking from an economist's perspective about whether the data represents a public good, and we have very specific concepts that would guide whether, in fact, that meets the criteria for public good. But generally, I like to think about it this way. In all markets, there has to be what's known as common knowledge. It's interesting, there's a lot of interesting theoretical work on this, that one way or another, everyone has to agree what everybody thinks everybody else understands. And that's exactly where the public good role comes in for USDA and NAS data. It provides the benchmark. It kind of sets what everyone else measures their data and their information relative to. And from a public good perspective, I'd make a rather strong statement that if you took the entire funding, the budget allocation to NAS for all of its activities, that the value produced to society as a public good in just the grain markets more than probably pays for the entire budget for NAS in terms of the public good data that's provided on crop size, inventory, and so on. I mean, Bob mentioned how much a single prospective plantings report moved the market. And we can argue about and quibble about did it get it just right or not, but we're really talking about, a with and without kind of argument. And it's pretty clear that the NAS current data system has a very high benefit-cost ratio. I think that you can make that argument very soundly. But I also think that there are places and things that NAS does that could be pretty quickly altered. It might take legislation, but the entire price reporting part of NAS is a bit of a mystery to me, and I know where it comes from legislatively, but there's a place where the private sector has really taken over, and there's just massive widespread price data that's available, at least in the grains, grain markets, and I don't see why there's really a compelling public good argument for reporting prices, at least in our major grain markets. It may be different in dairy and other areas, but in my world, I think it's hard to justify that expenditure if cuts have to be made.
I would just say, as far as the ability, like with the census, I'm interested in lending data. So if I sent out a survey to everyone on the mailing list and the cattle people were interested in that and they sent a survey out to everyone on the mailing list, producers wouldn't have any time to produce. They'd be trying to answer, and then you get no data after a while. So there's some efficiencies from standing back and the way NASS operates, but you know, I would never attempt to do that. Get lending data. They're just so from the public good standpoint, the mechanism you guys have developed over the years to do that works. It's the one how you provide data from a lot of different views. I go to the data lab and get it. I've got access there and put in the K codes and get what I want out of it. And but it's all lending specific. You know, I don't go beyond that. So that's my ability to quickly get valuable data for me.
You know, I guess I would remind ourselves that that much of the commodities that, or much of the products, I should have said that the right way, much of the products that USDA collects its data on are commodities, that they are, you know, kind of undifferentiated products to a large extent. You know, corn's corn. We could talk about number two or, you know, but bottom line is that they are commodities. A lot of producers or a lot of suppliers, a relatively limited number of buyers. And so when you kind of put all that together, you know, it is, I think, does meet an awful lot of the criteria for being a public good. You know, another thing to kind of keep in mind is that, you know, USDA's been doing this, I won't say since forever, but, you know, for a lot of, most of the folks in this room for forever. And so, you know, that being the case, it's kind of difficult to see, to conceive how the market might work without it. You know, think about, you know, corn production data. Would it be possible? I mean, we've got some folks out there that are doing private services today on estimating corn yields, you know that, and things of that nature. Is there a value that those guys gain by, you know, putting their report out to their private customers, you know, 24 hours before USDA, I don't know. But, you know, again, at the end of the day, what they're really doing is trying to guess what USDA is going to say tomorrow in reality. So when you kind of think about the whole spectrum of stuff that, whether it be BLS, whether it be Census, whether it be NASS collects, could there be a private service that could do all that for you? Yeah, maybe so, but I think it just you're just hard pressed to kind of mentally see how you'd make that move from where you are today to a completely private data collection service for, you know, kind of data for the nation. You're probably always going to have some role for the government. The other thing too to keep in mind is that you do want that confidentiality. You do want that impartiality. You do want folks that don't really have a dog in the fight, you know, reporting the data, that, you know, that they are the guys in the striped shirts that are, you know, collecting the information for you. And without that, if it's a private system, you know, you're kind of always going to want to say in the back of your mind, well, where are they making their money? How are they surviving? Shy of charging for the data? You know, that wouldn't be where the real money would be. Collecting the data wouldn't be where the real money was for a private organization. It would be providing that information to somebody before you provided it to the public. And why would that not necessarily happen in a private system?
You want a good current example of the potential conflicts? Just think of our investment rating agencies and the difficulties proposed in the recent financial crash by their activities.
Any more questions? I guess I would just make a comment, and I believe this is still the case, but back in the late 90s, I think it was early 2000, getting to the confidentiality issue that's been raised, there was a federal agency that I recall petitioned NASS for some specific survey data pursuant to a legal action that was being pursued by a group based around pesticide utilization and how they could get to where some of that was being used through the crop side, as under the basic assumption that if that crop was grown there, the likelihood that these pesticides would be applied there, hence we can make sure everything's according to Hoyle, if you will. And I believe it went all the way to the Supreme Court that NASA's authority to gather that information and aggregate it in such a way that you can't, by reading it, identify a specific producer or buyer or marketer or, you know, someone within that value chain, that if the survey pool is so small or so isolated or so unique, then that gets aggregated up to where that you can't identify that grower or that slaughterhouse or that grain elevator, whatever the case might be. So it went to the Supreme Court because EPA wanted that down to the ground level producer data to help in their response to a lawsuit. And the Supreme Court upheld NASA's authority to collect that data and assemble it in such a way that you can't get to individual producer numbers for any reason. Maybe the most helpful thought in the world to help this sector of producers or whatever, but that the Supreme Court has held that NASA's in place for the public good, the common knowledge sector here, not at the expense or identifying a particular producer or producer group or sector of the industry where they may have, you know, be able to be identified by sheer numbers. And so I think it's critical to hold on to that, and I would expect that at some point in time, having that that significant authority or recognition of the public good and the confidentiality aspect will have some role in this debate as this goes forward, I would assume. Any other questions? It's a big issue. Everything starts local, and global is here to stay, I think, and so a lot of sectors in between. If not, I would like to speak a little bit to Bob's point about this forum and today it's data collection. The Farm Foundation Forum started, 6 years ago, I think now, specifically looking at each individual title of the Farm Bill. And I think at the time there were 14 or 15 forums similar to this on each one of the titles. And so that Farm Bill, two of them now have come and gone. And we've continued at the foundation to look at current event issues and try to bring in experts to talk about those issues and think about where we're headed. So to that end, on October 11th, I believe that's our next forum date, we're going to be looking at the risk management side of how do you address risk management as maybe the key pillar of going forward in Farm Bill policy and looking at that risk management angle. So we'll not looking at a specific agency in particular, but we'll be addressing the public role, government's role in providing a farm safety net or risk management tools to production agriculture as we go forward. So mark your calendar, get in early. As you can see, seating's limited. Not really, we can always do more. But you're all welcome to be back, and we're lining up that series of panelists now. And so we'll be back on October 11th to talk about risk management. So with that, is there a question over here? Oh no, she's gonna clap. I should let her do that. So anyway, thank the panel for being here, and thank all of you for your time.